Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
Let's give it up for intern Matt filling in for Patrick. Clap your hands, say yeah. All right, day three here on this little fan mail string that we're doing. It's Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan. Patrick Foster is out for a bit, but I have with me intern Matt. Matt Windler. How you doing, Matt?
I'm doing great, Jim. Thanks for having me back.
Now, let me ask you this before we get going today here. You are in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and I am in the Washington, D.C. suburbs, and it's cold here today. It's, I don't know, the highs are like in the 40s Fahrenheit. Do you guys use the Fahrenheit or the...
No, we're Celsius.
Oh, so I don't know. Maybe this makes no sense. But anyway, is it cold there or is it, you know, what's the weather like up there?
It's been a little bit of spring weather, like a couple of warm days here and there, being, you know, a little over 10 degrees Celsius. So okay. I think that's 50 Fahrenheit, something like that.
Okay.
I lived in California for 3 years, but I just could not get with the Fahrenheit system. So it's above freezing. And for us, after a cold winter, that's usually shorts weather. The first time it hits like 15 degrees.
Yeah, I'm trying to convert this here now. Let me see here. I'm at 42 Fahrenheit right now. So what is that? That is 5 Celsius? That's not about right?
Yeah, 5. That sounds reasonable. Yeah, 15 degrees Celsius is about 60 Fahrenheit here. So we've had a couple of those warmer days.
Yeah, so we're at 5 right now. That sounds even colder than what I was thinking. 42 sounds better now by comparison. But anyway, It's you know, it should be warm here by now. I'm in the, you know, the American South. Technically, I'm in the South. It should be like nice and warm by this time of year. And I don't know. It's just sort of, yeah. One day it'll just be like super hot and humid, and then that'll just be our existence for like 6 months. So that's just how it'll work. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right, let's see here. Today we're going to talk about three different topics. We're going to start with a call here. All of these topics are from, I guess, earlier this year. There was an episode we did where I talked about a documentary on Apple TV about the Velvet Underground, and Harris King called in about that.
Hey, this is Harris in South Carolina. On my way home from teaching, I just listened to the episode on the documentary The Velvet Underground. I listened to it a day early as a patron of the podcast. Everybody else should become a patron of the podcast if you aren't already. Very well said, Jim. I watched it with my wife just like 2 nights ago. We watched it in the evening, you know, went to bed. The next morning, my wife's like, "What'd you think?" And I'm like, "I don't know." And she's like, "I don't know either." Like you said, it was a good documentary. It wasn't a great documentary. It was very well made. But I really don't feel like it was completely about the Velvet Underground, even though it's called that. It was more about the New York City art scene around Andy Warhol and the factory in the 60s, which is super interesting. The Velvet Underground were a part of it, but I feel like maybe almost should have been called The Factory instead of The Velvet Underground. I mean, the first 45 minutes, they didn't talk about The Velvet Underground. Sure, they talked about Reed and how he got to where he became the leader of The Velvet Underground, along with John Cale, and talked about him as well. But, you know, we hardly heard anything about the backstory of Sterling Morrison or Mo Tucker. We got more information on Doug Yule, I think, than those two, which... sure, he's great, but I don't know. It's just a little weird. And finally, I'm with you. I could listen to Jonathan Richman speak for hours on the Velvet Underground because he's enthusiastic. He is their super fan, which is just amazing to think about. He was a teenager, just hanging out, probably annoying as all get out, but still cool enough to be accepted by them. And then finally, John Cale produced The Modern Lovers a little while later. Just amazing stuff. The enthusiasm. I'm a huge Jonathan Richman fan anyway. I just want to hear him talk about the music. I want to hear about other people talk about the music. Great stuff. We watched it with our two cats in the room. They did not enjoy the viola played by John Cale in a lot of those songs. It was very disconcerting for them. So, anyway, keep rocking the suburbs.
All right. Thanks to Harris for the call there. And Harris, by the way, I mentioned yesterday Rockin' the Suburbs Radio at suburbsradio.com. Harris is another of our DJ contributors, so that's great. Okay, now this Velvet Underground documentary, I don't know if you've seen this, Matt, or you know much about the Velvet Underground?
I haven't seen the doc. I mean, I know a little bit. I really enjoyed the 1 week you guys did, I think, where you broke down their whole first album.
Oh, wow. That was a long time ago. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But
incredible band, but, you know, as I think I said on the previous episode, I think just really hard. There's something about the band that's kind of so hard to explain that even after you watch people talking about them, you're still kind of like, yeah, but I feel like there's more there that I still don't quite get. But anyway, but I would encourage people go, you know, if you have that service, I wouldn't necessarily go subscribe to Apple TV just for this. But if you have it already, you know, watch it. There's some interesting stuff there. But here's the thing. Here's what we're fortunate. We have somebody like Harris out there looking out for the animals, because if you have cats, possibly other animals in the house, you want to remove them from the room, put them in a safe space while you watch this documentary, apparently.
Yeah, I don't think the Velvet Underground's the best listening experience for sensitive ears. That's potentially
right. That's right. That's right. Do you have any pets, Matt?
No, not yet. A dog, many dogs will be in my future, though.
Many dogs?
I hope so.
Oh, you're a big... Oh, that's great. You're a big dog lover?
Yeah. Yeah. My brothers were always allergic growing up, so we never got to have our own. Ah. But any chance I get to, I dog sit for friends and family. And yeah, if I'm at a party and there's a dog, I'm the one that's on the floor playing with the dog.
All right. All right. This is good for me to know. I'll bring Shadow up sometime when I have a, you know, go on a trip somewhere. You can watch Shadow.
Absolutely.
All right. Oh, you guys would be good friends. Oh, that's it. So as big of a dog lover as you are, because of circumstance, you've never owned a dog.
Yeah, it's just not conducive to academic life, yeah. I don't think. Because you're moving around a lot, and I don't think it's really fair to them.
That's right. That's right. No, that's good. It's good the way you're thoughtful like that. That's good. So, but now that you're settled, soon mm-hmm. then, you think.
Yeah, I just got to get out of the renting game so I can control the animals I bring inside.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very nice. Okay. Well, let's move on here to, there was an episode about 1992 albums. I believe this was Noah Crane, listener Noah Crane, who brought this to us. By the way, Noah, also a DJ on Suburbs Radio, suburbsradio.com. Check him out. But he talked about some albums he really enjoyed from 1992, which would be 30 years ago. And Kevin Clement from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, left this Facebook comment. I thought this was pretty interesting because we were talking about a Lyle Lovett album, Joshua Judge's Ruth. And I was explaining how, like, I didn't really get Lyle Lovett at the time. And to be honest with you, I'm still not sure I really get Lyle Lovett. His music is fantastic, but he's really, like, kind of like we just saw at the Velvet Underground. It's sort of hard to explain what exactly he's doing. So, but I mentioned that he did, you know, sell a fair number of records, especially back in the 90s. And it was curious to me because he didn't seem to fit really like he was considered a country artist, but didn't really seem to fit in with country that was popular. And so here's what Kevin says, because Kevin's down there in Louisiana. He knows a lot about this stuff. He said, Lyle Lovett was not played much on country radio, at least in the Deep South back then. The younger crowd tended towards Garth Brooks and Wynonna, and the older listeners enjoyed artists like Vince Gill and George Strait. There were a lot of radio stations outside of the South turning to country music that I believed turned to more artists like Lyle Lovett and Mary Chapin Carpenter. Lovett has a very distinctive sound, which is a mix of folk and country gospel, among others, with incredibly witty lyrics. This appeal definitely helped him find an audience mostly outside of the Deep South.
his hand and fell behind her as his arm had reached around. Oh, and she looked at the window and she watched the shade go down. It was a private conversation. No one heard her say that man she left behind her was 2,000 miles away. A singing boy, pick up that fiddle. Ooh, and play that steel guitar. Ooh, and find yourself a lady. Ooh, and dance right where you are.
So there you go. I guess for me, I heard more of him back then. I would have been, I guess, in Illinois. So, yeah, my memory is that he probably got played a bit in the States on like public radio stations and things like that. So definitely had a more, you know, anywhere you would hear sort of more like eclectic kind of music, I guess, was what maybe we would hear Lyle Lovett. Have you listened to Lyle Lovett at all, Matt?
I haven't. I can't say. I was 1 year old in 1992. So a little outside of my wheelhouse, and it hasn't been one of those artists that I've gone back and discovered.
It's an interesting listen. When you get a chance, it's one of those artists who you really sort of have to pay attention to. It's not like background music kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, but if you're like in a right mood to really kind of like explore something different, it's good sort of like weekend morning kind of music, you know, when you sit down and just sort of relax a bit and listen to it. But I'd be curious to hear your thoughts when you get a chance. So,
okay. I'll have to give that a go. I do love a good weekend morning listen. Yeah. So
it's definitely not like when you say like, still all these years later, can't quite get my head around it, but it's not, when you think of country music, this is not exactly it. So, mm-hmm. Just, you know, it's different. Okay. Let's see here. We did an episode about opening acts, especially like when people, you know, went to go see one band and then by virtue of another band opening, they became a fan of that band. Like they discovered them, you know, through that dynamic. And I believe this was Kevin Bartlett, also a DJ on Suburbs Radio, suburbsradio.com. But Kevin Bartlett brought this topic to us. And let's see here. Let's start with this call from Rob Brown.
Hi, Rockin' the Suburbs. This is Rob Brown from Dunedin, Florida. I was just calling with a concert memory. The most shocking opening act I ever saw was at the drive-in in an emo sandwich between this local band, Hank Shaw, and Jimmy Eat World before Bleed American. I'd liked Jimmy Eat World before that. They put out some pretty decent music, and then they got signed to a major label and it was really bad. And in any case, I just kind of went because I had tickets and I wasn't expecting much. And at the drive-in was so electric. Cedric Bixler, Zolfa, and Omar Rodriguez Lopez were just wrapping themselves in guitar chords and singing like a younger version of Fugazi, who's probably my favorite band. So I think that really struck a chord with me. You know, they went on to form the Mars Volta and made some pretty amazing music. But that show is just startlingly good. I think one of my top 10 shows, even though they're definitely not one of my top 10 bands. So that's my story. Thanks so much for all your great shows.
All right. Thanks, Rob, for that call. All right. So that's good stuff. That's sort of, again, sort of the classic case of you go to see one band and then because you just really love the opener, you become a fan of them as well. So has that ever happened to you, Matt? You ever discover a band because they opened for somebody else?
I don't think I ever had like a life-changing opener kind of thing, but I really enjoyed, one that comes to mind is Dressy Bessie when they opened for Filthy Friends when I saw them in San Francisco. They were, yeah, one I hadn't known about and quite enjoyed.
I saw that same tour.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
on the first album.
Yeah. And Dressy Bessie. Yeah. And then I went up and I actually talked with the Dressy Bessie singer for a little while because, you know, the band was like sort of hanging over at the bar after their set. And so went over and talked a little bit. Yeah. So
I remember her being very dynamic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's the other cool thing about opening bands, especially in like a club setting like that. A lot of times you can go like meet them because they come out, you know, to like watch the headliner or stuff like that in a club setting. And sometimes you can like, you know, chat them up a bit. So that's pretty cool.
Open the door, walking behind her, draw back your
All right, let's see here. And then one last thing is a Facebook comment from Jay Ignacio. And I thought this was super interesting. Here's what he says. He says, kind of the opposite thing happened to me. Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah, the huge buzz in the mid-2000s. They were the opening act, but most of the people were there to see them. As soon as they finished, maybe 80% of the audience left. I stayed to check the up-and-coming headliner, The National. This was Alligator era, pre-Boxer. They blew me away. In retrospect, they were just approaching their prime. And then he sent a what he describes as a blurry camera photo image of that day. But I remember this band Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah, and how big they were in indie circles at that time, because I saw them at Coachella Festival in 2006, and they had this crowd that was just like super into their stuff and singing like all the songs and everything, and it was like really impressive. I was impressed because I just knew them as this weird little indie band, and to see how much enthusiasm and excitement there was from the audience, it was like really cool. So I know what he's talking about there, but the idea that then the headliner, for whatever reason in his story, was like sort of less known, I guess, but poised for greatness, being The National. Of course, we know how big they have become.
Mm-hmm. Has that ever happened to you, though, where like the headliner was less of a big deal than the opener?
No, I don't know how that would have worked exactly.
It seems like the person booking the show made a bit of a mistake. Yeah, that's right. There.
I've told this story on the podcast maybe a couple of times. I mean, I have gone to shows before where I personally was more interested in the opener than the headliner.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
But I can't say that they were necessarily like that it didn't make sense for that act to be the headliner. But anyway, that's weird. That's a weird one, but an interesting story. But he stuck around and he loved them, and I think he's probably largely responsible for the National's success. Jay.
And Taylor Swift's third era.
That's right. So, that's exactly right. Yes, we know.
Yeah.
All right. So that's it for the correspondence. Thanks very much, Matt, for hanging out with me.
I wish it was under better circumstances, but it's been my pleasure.
Appreciate it very much. And we're largely caught up on the correspondence. There might just be a couple other things that we'll get to later. But anytime people want to correspond with the show, they can email rock@suburbspod.com. They can call and leave a message. That U.S. number is
612-440-1984.
Yep. Or find us on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram @suburbspod. There you go. And as I mentioned before, check out Rock in the Suburbs Radio at suburbsradio.com. All right. Let's get out of here. Good vibes to Patrick Foster and his family, and he'll be back soon. And I'm Jim Lenihan here on Rockin' the Suburbs, and with me has been
intern Matt.
Thanks, man, and we'll talk to you all later.
Side note, speaking of record stores and Patrick, I tricked my way into getting a job at the best record store in Tampa, which is called Vinyl Fever, in the Rolling Stone even. And I fooled my boss. I'd recently been to Costa Rica, so when I told him I knew about Fugazi, I also mentioned I knew Elvis Crespo, and that was totally a lie. I just knew the one song that I had heard on the radio in Costa Rica. But he thought I was that diverse and got me the job, and luckily we're now friends, and he recognizes my inferior music knowledge. So not all record store employees are music savants. Some of us trick our ways into it.